if you can still remember where we are studying, the second epistle of John. The second epistle of John. And our studies in this very short epistle have been very, very disjointed. Our last one was on the 10th of June, and I think before that, it was 4 weeks before that. You see, we've had various missionaries and others. But at our last meeting on the Bible study in John, 2 John, what we did was this. We read right through the whole epistle. Well, after all, it's only 13 verses. And we did so with some amplification as we read to try to get a grasp of the theme running right through the epistle. I don't propose to do that again because we really must finish this little epistle tonight. But I would point out to you that John, it's clear when you read this epistle and have in mind the other writings of John, it is clear that John, the writer, the aged John, was very aware of the presence of Christ in the midst of the church. It's good every now and again to read the first chapter of the book of Revelation, the revelation of St. John. That magnificent picture of the glorious Christ, not only in the midst of the church, but holding the churches in his hand. It's a great thought, isn't it? Especially when you feel that everything's going wrong. Well, John's very aware of the presence of Christ in the midst of the church. It is clear also from his writings, not least the second epistle, that John is also very aware of the presence of the devil. And the aim of the devil, which is to confuse and to corrupt and to distract from the life and the work of the church. There is nothing that the devil likes better than commotion or confusion or tension or conflict. The devil's quite happy to let Christians do anything and everything if it will distract them from getting on with the job of doing the Lord's work. And John is also aware, and this is clear from all his writings, John is also aware of how both truth and love can be counterfeited. And right through this little epistle of 13 verses, there's a great emphasis on truth and love, and love and truth, and these two belonging together, and what God has joined together mustn't ever be put asunder. But John is aware that truth can be counterfeited so that lies seem to be truth. And love can be counterfeited so that what often is really weakness is accepted because it seems to be love. And in that context, in this little epistle, John, by the Holy Spirit, instructs us, he warns us, and he encourages us. And in the first six verses, the emphasis is on three things: truth, love, and obedience. These three. If you look, for example, at verse 3, where John says, grace, mercy, and peace will be with us. It's not a prayer. It's a statement. When we pronounce the benediction, we're really saying, may the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God the Father, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us. But this is not a prayer. This is a statement. And John says, grace, mercy and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father, Son, in truth and in love. I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children not everybody in the congregation, but some of your children following the truth, just as we have been commanded by the Father. And you remember, each time we've looked at that verse, I think we've reminded ourselves of the words of Jesus, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." It's not enough to admire the truth or to agree with the truth. We have to follow the truth. And so verses 1 to 6, truth, love, and obedience. And then we come to verse 7. Verse 6 introduces it. This is love, that we follow his commandments. You see, love is not really just feeling. Some people say love is a funny feeling. Well, I suppose it is sometimes. But this is love, says John, that we follow his commandments. This is the important thing, obedience. This is the commandment, as you have heard from the beginning, that you follow love. Because, now notice verse 7 begins with the word for. Here is the reason why we must have love and obedience in the truth. Because many deceivers have gone out into the world, men who will not acknowledge the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh, such a one is not a deceiver, but the deceiver and the Antichrist. And when we studied that verse, if I remember rightly, I pointed out that commentators are not quite sure just what this phrase, "have gone out into the world," really means. Whether it's people who have gone out from the church into the world. And that would seem to be backsliders or renegades, those who have turned their back upon the truth and they've gone out into the world in the guise of being Christian, but they do not go with the truth. Maybe what John is really thinking about here is that just as God the Father sent his Son into the world, so the devil has sent his messengers into the world. Many deceivers. And you know, that's something that's very important for our own day and generation, because we find that words come so near to us now, whether radio or television. There is an immediacy, and words, they're very powerful, and they can be very deceptive. And sometimes I find myself listening to someone, for example, on television, and inwardly I think I'm agreeing, and then I've said, I've got to say it myself. No, what's that man really saying? And then I've got to say, now, what is that man not saying? Then I begin to, no, I don't think I agree with him after all. But it's so easy to be taken in. Now, John says here, many deceivers are gone out into the world. Such an one is the deceiver and the Antichrist. And behind all deceivers, there is the arch-deceiver. And we really need to take quite seriously the words of Jesus to Peter. Remember at Caesarea Philippi? "Get thee behind me, Satan." Very frightening. That Jesus would call one of his closest friends Satan. When Judas came to the Garden of Gethsemane to betray Jesus with a kiss, Jesus didn't say, "You're an agent of the devil." Jesus said, "Friend, why have you come?" But to Peter, who was deceived, Jesus said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And that brings us to the 8th verse, which was the point at which we concluded our last Bible study in this epistle. Look to yourself. Now, this is right after speaking about the devil and his deceiving work. Look to yourselves, so that you may not lose what you have worked for. Look to yourselves in the sense of be careful who you listen to, and be careful what you listen to, so that you may not lose what you have worked for. And I just mentioned in the passing in the last Bible study in John, is it Revelation chapter 2 verse 4, where Christ speaks to a certain church and says, now, you look out and get right back on balance, because if you don't, I will remove your candlestick out of its place, and you won't be a church anymore. Now, that's really quite frightening. And when we spoke here about look to yourselves that you may not lose what you have worked for, I indicated that there were some references that we could look up, but we didn't have time then, so we do it tonight. And the first is in Galatians chapter 4 at verse 11. Where Paul says, I am afraid, Galatians chapter 4 verse 11, I am afraid that I have labored over you in vain. As if he was saying about a certain work in a certain congregation, all that costly work was for nothing. Turn over now to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2 at verse 16. He is urging the Christians to hold fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Oh, says Paul, I wouldn't like to think that I was losing my reward in respect of the work I did at Philippi. Hold fast the word of truth. Turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 at verse 5. When I could bear it no longer, I sent that I might know, that I wanted to be reassured that you're still standing in faith. And this is the kind of reference that encourages ministers a great deal when they realize that even Paul at times was worried sick, all uptight, in a sense almost going to pieces in terms of nervousness and worry. When I could bear it no longer, in a sense he was distracted from his work, I sent that I might know your faith, for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you, and that our labor would be in vain. I forget who it was who said it. I heard it first, I think, when I was a student in Aberdeen. Someone said, we need to pray more after the preaching of the word than before the preaching of the word. Remember the parable of the sower. The true seed was sown. The birds of the air snatched some of it away. But the next lot and the next lot came to nothing. The third lot, remember, showed a lot of promise. But in the end, it came to nothing. A marvelous parable, that the parable of the sower or the seed or the soil. But it's quite disturbing to think just how much of the sowing of the seed came to nothing. Back to John. Look to yourselves. You see, it's not only preachers that can lose their reward. Look to yourselves that you may not lose what you have worked for. I suppose in a sense a lot of the missionaries, the new missionaries, and people like Roger Pomeroy, who's so grateful that we've prayed for him for 23 years now. I'm sure the new missionaries and the long-standing missionaries all say the same kind of thing to the likes of us. Don't stop praying for us now. We don't want to lose out now. Look to yourselves, not least in terms of the many, many deceivers that are operating within and around the life and work of the Church of Jesus Christ. Look to yourselves that you may not lose what you have worked for, but may win a full reward. Remember, it was John later on in the letters to the churches in Revelation 2 and 3 who spoke to one church saying, "This was the word of the Lord. Oh, you've done a great job, but I have this against you. You have left your first love. You don't love the Lord, nor do you serve him in love and obedience the way that you once did." Losing a reward. Verse 9. Anyone who goes ahead. You know, there are some people who have been described to me as go-ahead Christians. Well, on one level, I'm quite happy with that kind of phrase, but look what John says. Anyone who goes ahead and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine has both the Father and the Son. Now, what does this mean? Anyone who goes ahead. Well, it means that right in the early days of the Christian church, there were those who were not standing firm in the faith once for all delivered to the saints. It means that even in the early days of the Christian church, just as there has been down through the generations of history to our own day and generation, there are those who consider themselves to be superior to or ahead of, more spiritual than others. Now, this is what John is speaking about. He seems, and this is what I think both F.F. Bruce and John Stott refer to in expounding this verse. It seems to refer to some Christians who are of the opinion that they have discovered, hold to, advanced teaching. I think I just touched on this briefly on one occasion. For example, people who tend to say, as they said then, and as people say now, we don't need the scriptures, we have the Spirit. Now, there are people who say that nowadays. And they tend usually to break away from established denominations and set up their own spiritual. No, they can't stay in a non-spiritual church. It's like the two dear ladies who used to come to Sandyford periodically for about 5-6 months at a time. Used to often wonder what their own minister thought about it when they disappeared for six months Sunday evenings. And oh, week after week they would say to me, oh, how much they were blessed and how rich the ministry was and this and that and the other. And I don't think I was terribly impressed with them. And one Sunday evening at the church door they were going on like this. Oh, the ministry, oh, there's nothing like it. And on they went and in they had. And you know, Mr. we just don't understand how you can stay in the Church of Scotland. So being me, I said, well, but you've been coming to the Church of Scotland every Sunday evening for the past 6 months and have been blessed. I said, you said to me that God's here blessing people. That's why I'm in the Church of Scotland. But you see the attitude. I'm not being too critical of these. They were dear old ladies. But for various reasons, they couldn't understand why God would do anything in a place like the Church of Scotland. But then you see, on a more serious level, there are those who take this advanced position that we don't need the scriptures. We have the Spirit, and the Spirit speaks to us directly, you see. And these people tend always to say, and it goes along with it, we don't need preaching, because we are all taught by the Spirit. We don't need to come to church. Now, there are people who say that, because they believe that they have advanced so far that they really don't see any need now to gather with all these rather substandard Christians. Now, that's exactly what John is speaking about. Now, I'm glad, for example, that the UCCF have got back to the old pattern that if you're invited to speak at a Christian Union at a university, each time you have to re-sign the doctrinal basis, as if to say, I still stand by the basic biblical doctrines of the faith. That's where I stood before, I still stand. And they don't allow that kind of thing to be operate for several years. Every year when the committee is making up its syllabus, you get the letter wondering if you can come and speak on such and such a subject, and I enclose a copy of the doctrinal basis for you to sign. And if you don't sign the basis, then you don't speak. I'm glad. And it is usually on the doctrine of the inspiration and authority of Scripture that many people slip. Now look what John says. Anyone who goes ahead and does not abide, that happy to stay in the doctrine of Christ, does not have God. That's pretty radical, isn't it? I'm glad I'm not the person who said it. But notice what follows from that. Does not have God. And that means that no matter the competence, I think it's speaking mostly here of preachers, no matter the preacher's competence, no matter the attractiveness of his preaching or his personality, and no matter his popularity and acceptability, God is not in it. And the reason that God is not in his preaching is simply that the man is not with God. Anyone who goes ahead and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. And anyone who goes onto a platform or into a pulpit and does not have God is spiritually a very dangerous person. This is one reason why we've got to be very, very careful before we preach. And this is one reason why I and many other ministers don't like anybody at all coming to our vestries with all sorts of bits and pieces of information and that the last 5 or 10 minutes before a service. Because we are aware of the fact that if we go into our pulpits and we ourselves are not with God and God is not with us, then we are putting the whole of the congregation in spiritual danger. And to my mind, it is quite amazing that it is John, the apostle of love, who speaks these very, very solemn and searching words. And I emphasize them tonight, and I'm glad I've had time to do so, because in our own day and generation, we seem to be slipping, rather, without people noticing it, into a Christianity, or sometimes even into an evangelical Christianity, without clear and distinctive doctrines. I think I could give you illustrations of that, but I find a certain reluctance in my spirit so to do. So I want you just to accept what I say and think about it. On a wider level, we have the kind of Christianity nowadays in many areas which seems to include or want to include all religions as equally valid. I heard of one committee meeting, I think it was, there's certainly a discussion, I think it was about overseas work, and it was the Reverend Stanley Hood of Anderson Church, who is, well, theologically he doesn't stand where I stand, but it was the Reverend Stanley Hood who broke into the discussion and said, but we've got to remember that Jesus said, I am the way. And that's the only way. But this kind of confusion, this rather distorted concept of love and tolerance and all that kind of thing, is one of the main problems of the whole area of religious education in schools, which so very, very often is not Christian or biblical education. And of course, one of the other problems is, how can you have a school teacher who doesn't believe a thing teaching children biblical lessons? Think of the verse we've just been reading. The person who doesn't have God is spiritually dangerous if they try to handle the things belonging to God. There's a great deal being said, and no doubt much more is going to be said, about the fact that we are in a multi-faith society. But the fact of a multi-faith society does not, can not, and must not be allowed to change the doctrines of the gospel. The heart of which gospel doctrine concerns Jesus Christ, God's eternal Son, whose atoning death is the only way of forgiveness and reconciliation to God. Anyone who goes ahead and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine has both the Father and the Son. And that last statement is quite beyond me to expound, but I sure like it. He has both the Father and the Son. You could almost say, have you anybody staying with you this weekend? Yes. The Father and the Son. My word. You see why I can't expound it? Some things are better felt than dealt. Now the last verses. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into the house or give him any greeting. Now, this warning refers back to verse 7 and the many deceivers, the false teachers. And this is the kind of verse that can be used to criticize ministers who are in what are called compromised denominations. And this is the kind of verse that can be used to justify every separation and every excommunication. But the verse is all about preachers and teachers. John is not here referring to confused believers, because the best thing to do with a confused believer is to take him in. Remember Priscilla and Aquila, who listened to the marvelously eloquent Apollos? What a preacher he was. And these two in the congregation, he doesn't understand. So they invited him home for lunch. And he stayed with them for a while. And they cleared his confusion. So this is not about confused believers. Nor has this verse got anything to do with division of opinion in secondary matters, such as, for example, the form of baptism, or the form of communion, or the form of ordaining ministers to the ministry, and all that kind of thing. And this 10th verse, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into the house or give him any greeting, this doesn't even refer to some individuals who deny the truth. It is referring to traveling preachers and teachers. This 10th verse is really a very important verse with regard to who is allowed to go into your pulpit and preach to your congregation. Now, there are quite a few people that I wouldn't allow into my pulpit. I don't proclaim the reasons from the housetops. I just try to keep out of the road altogether. But you see, who is allowed into the pulpit is very important. And John is speaking here in these very strong terms, because the issue he is dealing with affects the future of the church as well as the present. Now, I've got a whole list of references here, and I'm afraid we haven't got time to look them up. References in 1st and 2nd Timothy about the danger of false teachers, the importance of holding to the truth, the importance of staying with the scriptures, and the important aspect of any man's ministry of teaching faithful men who in their turn will teach others. So you see, one of the great burdens of ministers who begin to get on in years is that they want to see the next generation of ministers ready and able to minister the whole counsel of God, and to see indications of the next generation after that and another generation after that. And we've got echoes here again about being careful lest that we may not lose what we have worked for. And I think we need to be praying a lot for the ministry of our own denomination. It's very, very important. And I think we need to be praying a lot, I think possibly privately rather than the prayer meeting, for evangelical ministers, so that none of the pressures and demands will entice them away from the heart of their work, which is the ministry of the Word. Quite a famous and prominent minister who said to me on one occasion that his theological position was very, very much nearer mine than most people realized, said to me on one occasion that when he's the visitor, I mentioned that he'd been preaching in somewhere, said to me something like this. Oh, he said, yes, I'm quite enjoying it. But I like to have my prayers very carefully prepared. But I don't bother so much about the preaching. I just take it as it comes. And I thought that was one of the saddest things I'd heard a minister saying for a long time. And sometimes when I'm on holiday, whether here or elsewhere, I don't mean Sandyford, I mean Scotland or elsewhere, sometimes as I sit in church on Sunday, I become aware of the fact that the man's sermon was almost certainly prepared with a very tired mind rather late on the Saturday evening. And it is evident. And that is no way to break the bread of life. I'd hope to finish this tonight, but we'll leave it there because there's lots to pray about. And we'll come back to these words of the old minister Paul to the young minister Timothy with regard to the nature of his ministry. And then we'll go on and say a word about Christian hospitality. And then we'll come to the last verses where John says, though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Did I quote the other week someone saying, I think it was my brother in his notes saying, paper and ink can't smile. And sometimes it's best to speak. But when I was thinking about that verse, I found myself wondering, was John thinking back to the day that he heard Jesus saying, I have many things to say to you yet, but you're not ready to receive them. And John says, oh, I'll be the same with this little congregation that I'm writing to. I don't want to overburden them. I don't want to hurry them along too quickly. And it made me think of what a wise and wonderful teacher we have in Jesus, who takes us and leads us as we are able, on and on and on and on. So forgive me for not finishing 2 John tonight. I don't think it's a big sin, do you? Let's sing our other hymn before we go to prayer.